A quick note for our listeners. This Radio Parkies presentation is sponsored by YOPN Network and includes people who have been living with Parkinson's for quite some time. The vocal challenges that you hear are due to the progression of this disease as well as deep brain stimulation surgeries. And we come as we are here. Everyone has a purpose and a contribution, and everyone is welcome. Thank you for listening.
You are unique, active, determined, resilient. You are not your diagnosis, and you are not alone. This is Young Onset Parkinson's Network. We believe young onset Parkinson's disease does not define you. You define it. We are a safe place to learn, connect, and engage within a supportive community that actually gets it, because we've got it too. Welcome to Young Onset Parkinson's Network. Living well starts here.
We'll be back with Jimmy in 30 seconds.
Join us as we reconnect with guests we spoke to over 5 years ago, who bravely shared their experiences and provided valuable insights into the nuanced transformations they've encountered since then. Prepare to be inspired as we delve into their extraordinary achievements, explore their mental well-being, uncover their exercise regimens, dietary choices, and go beyond. 5 years later, a podcast series from the Young Onset Parkinson's Network. We hope you'll join us. And if you look up the name Jimmy Choi, who is our first guest, you might find yourself on a site for shoes. You might find yourself looking up chimichurri sauce recipes, depending on how fast you say his name. Don't ask me how I know this. But this is not a name that needs an introduction, because Jimmy has had Parkinson's since age 27. He's not a slacker in any capacity. And when he's not putting himself out there for Parkinson's, he's a dad, a partner, a friend. Consistently humble, even when he's mugging for shots with Michael J. Fox. Michael J. Fox once said he's inspired by Jimmy. But I don't think that was Jimmy's idea when he stepped into this arena. He's here to help. He's an advocate. We're happy to talk to him and gather some advice. Welcome, Jimmy.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. As well as I can be.
We have so many questions for you today. I don't even know where to begin.
I think those of you who know me know that I am an open book. So we'll just fire away and see where this conversation takes us. I'm excited to revisit. It's been 5 years. It's been a long time.
I think it's only appropriate that we give you the opportunity to start with a good dad joke. You got any for us?
Oh, now you're putting me on the spot.
Come on, Jimmy. Come you through.
All right. Okay. What do you call a latte that's not feeling well?
Oh no.
Oh, man, coffee.
Oh, all right. So I know Heather's got a whole list of questions for you, and we're all excited to jump in with her and ask away. So Heather, tap away at this chiseled man of Jimmy Choi.
Jimmy, since you have been called inspiring, and I know that can be probably sore there. How do you feel about that, first of all? And then secondly, where do you get your inspiration from?
Being called inspired, many people have said that. And I'm just a guy out there doing me. I always say that everything that I've done, I don't know how people define as inspiration, but really I'm out there doing things on a very selfish note, and that's how I got started, right? I was looking for ways that I can live better. I was looking for ways to make myself better. Everything was very selfishly driven. I even talked about back, you know, when I was doing, 12, 13 years ago now, when I was just doing clinical trial after clinical trial, those are people are like, well, Jimmy, you gave away, you know, you're giving away your body for science. I'm like, yeah, kind of, but it's really for selfish reasons, right? Because if I participated in a clinical trial and that was the cure, I'd be the first to get it. It really was a selfish reason why I was doing all that. So I don't know. I mean, I was just out there doing me, and people call me an inspiration because I guess they all saw something that they can learn from. And over the years, that has evolved to me realizing that if I just continue sharing the things that I'm doing while I am still doing me, if others can learn from it and they can do something within their own lives with some of the things that I'm doing, then that's great. So if that's what the inspiration of a if that's the definition of an inspiration, then so be it. But for me, my inspiration comes from my family. Every day I wake up in the morning, it's for them. Every day I wake up, it's how do I get my kids ready to so that they can get to what they need to get to and get to the next point in life. My daughter, college is coming up. My son is entering high school. You know, my wife is working. Cheryl's working hard every day to keep us all sane and together. And I know as a care partner, she needs time and she needs to have some things too. So, you know, that's my family. It's everything that I'm doing is for them. I'm trying to make sure that I can still be a partner to her for everything that life is going to throw at us for as long as I possibly can. So that is my inspiration to continue to drive this for my family.
The theme of today is 5 years ago. So 5 years ago, Mason and Karina weren't teenagers, maybe Karina was just a teenager. So how has life changed now that you have two teenagers?
Oh, man, that's a good question. you know, 5 years ago, it was a lot easier because they kind of went where we went, right? Because Karina was only 5 years ago, Karina was only 10 years old, 11 years old, and Mason was 8, right? So they kind of went where we dragged them, and they're not a lot of our lives revolved around them. Their lives revolved around us. But as they got older and older, they made friends. They started getting involved in activities. Karina is involved in sports. Many people know that she's very involved in softball. And Mason's learning how to fly. He's going to have his pilot's license before he learns how to drive. So, you know, as they develop their interests, that has changed. Now, our lives, my life, revolves around theirs. And I really just want to be able to give them, and it gives me a lot of joy and a lot of pride to watch them grow and excel and learn the things that they're interested in, knowing that this could be part of their futures, or if not, they're going to learn some great lessons from it. So I think that really the biggest difference is, yeah, it's they used to live their lives around us, and now we live our lives around them. And I only see that going more and more towards that direction, especially for the next, you know, another 5 years as they get into college and beyond.
So Jimmy, 5 years ago compared to today, how does your body feel?
You know, I'm not going to lie and say everything is great. I will say that compared from 5 years ago to now, I definitely can say that there has been progression of Parkinson's. But at the same time, 5 years ago to now, I've done different types of training so that I've prepared my body well for what Parkinson's has to deal today for me. You know, for example, in the last 5 years, and before that, I was doing a lot of endurance type training, really just focusing on a high intensity of getting my heart rate up. But now I'm doing that along with functional training in terms of everyday life. How can I maintain balance? And then the little things that I do in the gym are more calisthenics focused, and this works for me because as I focus on calisthenics, if you think about it, calisthenics is the in the fitness world is the art of moving your own body weight around, right? So if I can master the best to my ability calisthenics, for me, I am learning how to move my own body weight around in the gym. In return, that should translate to moving my own body weight around on an everyday basis. So, 5 years ago to today, I think my body is prepared differently for how Parkinson's is trying to punch back, but I'm also punching back very differently than I was with the things that I was doing 5 years ago.
Can you talk about how many hours a day you train?
I try not to deviate from my training regimen and exercise on the daily. My typical day is getting up at 5 a.m. and it takes me about an hour to get out of bed and get my body moving. And then once my body's moving, I'm in the gym at 6:30, I will be in there for as long as it takes me to get 45 minutes of true high intensity workout, meaning 45 minutes where my heart rate is spent up in the 75% plus of my max. So I don't leave the gym until I reach that goal. Sometimes that takes 2 hours. Sometimes it takes an hour and a half. Sometimes that takes straight 45 minutes, depending on what I'm doing. But once I've hit that goal, anything above that is icing, so to speak. So that is my daily regimen. I don't come home until I hit that goal. That is my job. As many of you know, I am retired from my professional day job many years ago. And my job is to keep this body going. I don't do that 7 days a week. I do it for 3 days and then I take one rest day and then I hit it for 3 days straight again. And then I take another rest day and I just sort of rinse and repeat and lather, continue that cycle. Now throughout the day, I'm trying to stay as active as I can, as long as I can. But I'm not gonna lie to you guys. I hit that Parkinson's fatigue every day right around 2 o'clock. So soon today, I can already feel it coming on. And then my body becomes, for the lack of a better term, useless for a couple hours. And I just gotta either nap or just sit there and relax and just kind of let my family do their thing. And then I try to claw my way back for nighttime and just keep moving at it.
And in your spare time, you've been doing 105 marathons.
That's the right number. In the last 12 years, I've done 105 half marathons. Wow.
So you mentioned rest. I'm amazed. Like, do you have any advice for people who want to be in this for the long haul?
Yeah, I mean, if you're in this for the long haul, you have to develop self-discipline. Self-discipline and self-love. And that's what it is. And when I say self-love, it's not, you know, going out and get yourself pampered, although that's important too. But when I say self-love, it really is, you have to develop that love for your own body and abilities to keep pushing forward every day. Every day you have to make time to suffer, okay? Because let's be honest, nobody likes your heart rate at 75% of their max heart rate for 45 minutes on any given day. That's kind of, when you're going through it, it kind of feels like suffering, but you got to make time in your day for it. And that goes in hand with having the discipline to go out and do it every day. Once again, I'm not saying everybody should do that. I'm saying everybody should find the right type of exercise for them and that they should be doing that, the right type of exercise for them every day and every chance that they get, and maintain self-discipline, maintain the course of action. Even when they have crappy and shitty days, they got to get out there and do what they can. Every day is not going to be a personal best day. In fact, personal best days are far in between for me nowadays, but give it my best days is every day.
Just to bounce off what you said, I'm glad you brought up suffering. One of the Rinpoches, whose name I won't try to pronounce, said that there are four benefits of suffering: wisdom, resilience, compassion, and a deep respect for reality, meaning stay here right now. and try to escape. I notice you have a lot of compassion. Do you remember when you called me? I was having a really rough time. I left you some messages and you left one of your kids' games. You came to talk to me. You talk about compassion, please, thanks.
You know, it's that you know, just things like that isn't, I don't know what's the word I to describe that, but when I sense that somebody really needs my help, there are sort of bigger fish to fry, so to speak, right? I mean, games with my kids, my daughter's games are important, but and that day it was more important to speak to you, Heather. So that was the right thing to do. It's not always like that because life gets in the way. People have things to be, places to be, and things to do. But I think if we can all spend a little time and just think, if there's somebody out there that needs a little bit more than we are, you know, that just needs us a little bit more than our current situation calls for our attention, that is the right thing to do. So don't mention that, Heather. It was good talking to you. It was as good as it was for me, if nothing else.
I was kind of really on the same page as Heather, and I had similar questions that she tackled. Like Jimmy's reached out to me in the past just because he was in the area, said, "Hey, you want to catch a workout with me?" And I appreciated the heck out of it. You know, and Jimmy's got so much to teach too. Even there was a second time in Vegas recently when he was being drugged across the country by his daughter, as he was saying, he does what she does now. But he got to sneak away and we did some ninja training. It turns out I really suck at ninja courses, but Jimmy took the time to like really show me, no, you don't actually suck at it. It's just your form sucks. So
technique. I said your technique.
There you go. Technique. That's what it was. But no, I think there's probably countless people at this point in your life, Jimmy, that have similar experiences to Heather's and mine. And now standing on this side of the 5 years later, looking back, How does it feel? And just be honest, like as a dude, you don't have to give us some mumbo jumbo personal or speaker stuff. Just from your heart, how's that feel?
It's I don't know. I'm kind of lost over words every time somebody asks me that, and I always give a slightly different answer, I think, because it's like I said in the beginning, my journey started through very selfish intentions, right? And you know, through even 20 years into living with PD, and really, it's 20 years since I've been diagnosed, but really, I think it's only been 13 years of truly living with PD, because that's when I started to take action to live my best version of me with Parkinson's. I still think it's still very selfish intentions. I think everything that I'm doing somehow comes back and benefits me, because you know, if I help somebody else, it makes me feel good. It makes me feel good. So I do it more because it makes me feel good.
So Jimmy Choi is a selfish dude. You'll never convince me of it, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah. So you spoke a little bit ago, Jimmy, about your physicality 5 years later, but you didn't really touch on your mentality. How has your mentality changed over the course of these 5 years? I remember in that interview, you were disappointed in your run on American Ninja Warrior. I was saying before you got here, I would venture to think that if you had that run today, you'd be happy with it. But your mindset has to have shifted. How has it changed in 5 years?
Yeah, you know, nowadays, as before, as I was getting, you know, it's because I was really closer to, you know, closer to the peak of my my physical rise, despite living with Parkinson's, right? I think I was still seeing gains and I was still seeing improvements in every aspects of my physical sense. I was still shooting for PRs. I had high expectations for myself. I was shooting to win. I was really like I wanted to go out there and I wanted to win. And for me, winning was the best way to say, you know, F you to PD. I think today I come to the realization that it's not just Parkinson's. Even if we put Parkinson's in the back burner, aging itself is going to slow people down, right? So I needed to stop comparing myself to who I was, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or even 10 years ago. Because just if you look at anybody, even without Parkinson's, there's that time where your physical abilities in terms of gains and hitting personal bests are going to plateau, and you're not going to see those again, right? And I've accepted that. And I think that has helped me in the last, especially in the last 3 years, it has helped me with my own training and mental challenges when it comes to the block of, I need to be at my best. I need to be at this level, that level. Knowing that for me now, if I can let go of the past and saying that, okay, forget shooting for the best that I've ever been, but really shooting for the best that I can be today. So that's really where I am right now. I know that I am, you know, I left Ninja Warrior after five seasons because the training has just beaten me down. My elbows, my joints, my muscles are just killing me. And, you know, again, taking that, even without Parkinson's, that would be the same for anybody at my age. So I can't always say, well, it's because of PD I'm doing this, but no, I still have PD, but I'm going to give my best effort to be the best me right now. So that's the biggest shift in my training mentality, I think, is stop shooting, stop aiming for that, you know, wherever I was 10 years ago, and really start aiming for where I can be right now.
Jimmy, do you ever think about DBS?
Yes. So I actually attempted DBS three times. Once before my third season on American Ninja Warrior, that was supposed to be my last. And then COVID hit. So all elective surgeries were put on hold. So that was the first time. And I was qualified and everything was set to go. And then when COVID hit, that surgery was canceled. And once everything came back and we were doing surgeries again, more than 6 months had passed. So I had to go through the entire evaluation again. And then the second time I went through the evaluation, I decided to go back on Ninja because I participated in those vibrotactile stimulation glove studies with Dr. Peter Tass over at Stanford. And it provided me with some improvements to my movement abilities and actually my UPDRS scores off medication showed more than 30% improvement, and even a little bit more when I'm on medication. So because of that, I decided to hold off DBS at that time, which now has come back to bite me in the ass, because when I last year I went back to go through the qualifying process again, I went into the stage where we get an MRI to make sure everything is good in terms of path, where the leads need to go and where everything needs to drop. Unfortunately, there are some blood vessels that are now in the way of where the leads need to go that increase my chances of having an aneurysm on the table. So they said, no, you cannot do this because the risks are too high. So as of right now, I no longer qualify for DBS, but we are going to go back. The doctors think because of my physical activity, neuroplasticity has an effect on how your brain is structured and where these blood vessels move and change. So we're just going to keep monitoring. We're going to go back and we're going to reevaluate every year and see if those blood vessels keep moving and get out of the way at some point so that I have a clear path and then I can bring DBS back on the table again.
Do you have any sense of how you got Parkinson's? Was there any environmental factor or anything you may or may not have been exposed to? Just curious.
Yeah, I think so. Many hits over the head, you know. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, I played a lot of contact sports. I was a wrestler. I played football, and I was an offensive lineman. I was a big guy back then. I was an offensive lineman. So we cracked heads every play, every down, every play, we cracked our heads together with somebody. And back in the late 80s and 90s, when you get a concussion, you get a little bit of sniffing salt and you get your ass back on the court, on the field, and you played. You get your bell rung again, you come out and you sit out for a few plays and you go back in as soon as you can remember who you are.
That brings new meaning to the song Ring My Bell.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so that obviously is could have been a big factor for me. And just given my family history, you know, I was diagnosed, and then my grandmother was diagnosed much, much later in life than I was. But other than that, no other family members have had it. So it's not so much the environment that we all lived in together, I don't think. But I think for me, it was more of a trauma issue.
Me actually, has that shaped the way that you approach your children's activity in sports?
No. I've always said, that if my kids want to play football, they want to wrestle, I was going to support it. The lessons that I've learned playing those sports, as a team sport in football, about strategy and just the discipline that I learned from the sport itself has set me up well in life, I believe. Wrestling is a very technical sport. It requires a lot of thought, a lot of strategy as well. And kind of like chess, you have to plan your moves ahead before you make them.
Endurance.
So, you know, these are things that are going to, if my kids choose to pursue these, I'm not going to stop them, because number one, we know more about concussions nowadays. There are a lot more safety measures in place today. You know, that doesn't protect them from broken legs and things like that, but I've broken stuff just walking down the stairs, right? So yeah, no, that hasn't changed my mentality on my kids if they want to participate in that stuff.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I was lining up and hitting each other every play. I think football has something to do with mine too.
Yeah, no offense, Mike, but when you play, your helmets are probably thinner than mine.
Sure. No face mask either.
Yeah, Mike, right.
Tell me you've got it handy and put it on, Mike. Show us the helmet.
Just like putting a baseball glove over your head is what Mike used.
I was a safety, but I got my bell rung quite a bit too. I definitely wasn't doing it every play, but I think it definitely had an effect on me as well.
Mike was a legend in high school and college when he played.
Yeah. Me, not so much. I just played. Look at that. Yeah, that's exactly
the
there
you go.
There he is. Let's go play, Jim.
Yeah. No, I had the full face mask and everything. I even had the visors.
What is that thing?
Helmet.
It's a watermelon, Ryan, is what it is.
Right? So you really did have to walk both ways uphill in the snow and wear a leather helmet.
With no shoes on.
With no shoes on, that's right.
So, Jimmy, 5 years ago, you talked about things like falls, just to fall. How is your balance these days?
I still fall. That's something that I don't think I can get away from. Even with all the athletic training and balance training that I do, my fall comes from freezing moments. So when my feet stop moving, but my upper body is still going, that's when I go timber and I tip over. You know, all the burpees that I've done really has served me well. It allows, it really has developed a muscle memory, so to speak, so that when I do take that fall, I can brace my fall with my upper body. My hands, my arms still work, even though my legs weren't moving, my arms are still working. I can soften that blow to the ground and ultimately get back up. Falling is still an issue today. I am definitely extra careful going up and down the stairs. And I just saw Mike scurry on down the stairs for his helmet, like so fast. I was very envious, Mike, of that moment, that how quickly you move down the stairs and back up. But you know, my wife and I are you know, already looking at our final retirement home, and it's going to be a ranch style. There's going to be no stairs.
So I actually have a question for Ned. Ned lives in fairly close proximity to you, so he's been privy to a lot of your feats. Ned, what's the most impressive thing that you've ever witnessed this man do?
Well, I have to go with the most recent, very public thing he did was the plyometric push-up world record. I still don't have any comprehension how you guys did that. Maybe for the audience who may not be familiar with it, explain the achievement.
So think of, this one was tough. It really was. Training for it was very painful. Just imagine doing a push-up, and right in the, at the top of each push-up, you're going to give a high five to somebody else. And I mean, that's really it. For every push-up, your hands come up off the ground. You extend forward, you give a high five, and your hands are back down, and then you go into another push-up immediately, and you continue that process. It takes a lot of coordination, and that coordination for me, this is a tandem world record, meaning there's two people, and the other person lives all the way across the world in London, and he doesn't have Parkinson's, and he's half my age, so the challenge there is really to keep the synchronized throughout this whole thing. But and we also train separately, right? He's in London, I'm here in the States. We had to find ways to train. But now it really was one of the tougher things that I've ever had to do.
Can you talk about how hard it was to find a training partner that could do as many as you could do?
Yeah. So Ned comes, you know, used to come to my gym every once a month, it was almost, right, Ned?
Yeah, for a while there.
Yeah, and so he knows a lot of people that I train with, and I trained with Ninja Warriors. I trained with some world-class athletes, and trying to get them to get people to train at the level that I needed to train and the numbers that I needed to hit in terms of plyometric push-ups and also weighted push-ups was almost impossible. I think the most I've ever done with a training partner in my own gym was like 12 reps.
And how many reps did you do for the world record?
And we ended up doing 50 for the world record. So
and your partner had the same issue, didn't he?
He couldn't find anybody in London to do it with him so that he can get the timing down. Didn't have anybody he can find that can do it the same amount that he needed to do. I think the most he ever got to was like 17 or 18 or something like that himself. So we ended up having to set up targets on the wall, and we would just hit the wall. Right? We would push ourselves off the ground and hit targets on the wall and see how many we can get there. And then when we met each other finally, because this was done in Italy, we met each other there, and we had 2 days to work together before we were to do the actual record attempt in front of a live studio audience, by the way. So yeah, it took us 2 days to get our timings down, and then we just went for it, and everything fell into place.
No pressure.
No.
Speaking of hitting walls, how do you deal with injuries, and what are your freezing strategies?
Injuries first. No matter what happens, I always treat my injuries as their own ailment, as their own issue. I never say, "Oh, I got an injury is because of PD," and wait the 6 months or the 4 months to talk to my MDS. "Oh, I've got a little sore elbow. You know, is this PD related?" No, I don't want to wait the 4 to 6 months. Right? Any new injury that I get, whatever it is I might be feeling, I first go to a specialist for that particular ailment, whatever it is that I'm feeling. Maybe it's an orthopedics specialist for any joint related stuff. If I get a cold, I'm going to my doctor's. But whatever it is that I'm feeling that's new, I am going to treat it as of its own issue on its own and not related to PD first. So that's how I've been dealing with it. And it's worked well for me. And then only when I completely run out of avenues, so to speak, then I would say, all right, maybe this is related to PD. So that's how I treat injuries now. And I think I would be doing that for for a long time. Now, when it comes to any strategies with freezing, a couple interesting things that I've done is when I go out for a walk outside or when I run, you know, I started taking my dog with me. So, you know, with freezing, it's, when these things happen, it's usually a change of scenery, a change of focus in your eyes. For me, at least, that's what I found out. Like, you know, some people walk through a doorway and they freeze in the doorway. Or some people that walk on those the crosswalks, the zebra crosswalks on pedestrian walkways. Every one of those lines that goes past your feet and you lose focus on it, and then you have to focus on the next line. That's when freezing occurs. That's why so many people freeze in the middle of the street. Right, terrible thing to happen. For me, it's when I'm running outside. I would fixate on an object, right? Because I'm always looking for short-term goals. I'm just going to run to that car up ahead. And then when I run to that car, if I got more in the tank, I'm going to go on to the next tree. When I shift the focus from the car to the tree, that's when freezing happens. And that's when I fall. But when I started running with my dog, she was trained to run 6 feet in front of me and my focus is on her. So my point of focus never changes, right? So if my point of focus never changes, then I'm not, my brain isn't skipping a beat looking to focus on the next item, then my fall chances fall down, drops down significantly. I have never fallen when I was running with Holly. She doesn't run so much now. She's an older dog now, so she doesn't run so much anymore with me. I try to instill those strategies when I'm outside walking. Instead of looking at focusing on closer targets, I'm focusing on targets that are further away. And then I'm also immediately as these targets are getting closer, I'm not waiting for it to fall out of sight before I look for my next one. I am making a conscious effort to shift my target focus down the road, so to speak, a little sooner than later. That doesn't work 100% of the time, but I feel like it's helped me significantly in terms of just when I'm walking or when I'm running by myself nowadays.
So Jimmy, what you're describing is dual tasking, right? So yeah. It's the ability to move well and think well at the same time. Do you do anything to improve your cognition or anything to improve the mind as far as its impact on that freezing?
Yeah, I try to think of stupid dad jokes. No, seriously though. So a lot of the exercises that I do are unilateral movements, meaning it's one side of the body to the other, and it's also changing the direction in which I move. So that's forcing me to dual task. It's forcing me to think what my next move is before I have to make it, right? So if in the gym, that's what I do. But I also, you know, play a lot of mind games. Lately, it's been more backgammon. There's strategy in backgammon. My kids say, "You're playing backgammon? Did you all of a sudden turn 80 years old?" Yeah, I find that it's an easy game to play, and you can find tons of people to play online, different various levels. All those things are helping with the thought process, I think, because it's just little things like that to keep your mind sharp.
Have you deal with non-motor symptoms like depression, anxiety, and it's so hard to get through it?
Yeah, it's a tough one because I like to say that I go through cycles. There are cycles where I do feel down and sad. I don't really know how to describe how I get through it. For me, I don't want to say it's like meditation, but really it's just sort of centering myself, trying to calm myself in those situations. Whenever anxiety hits or depression hits. I think with depression, I try to sort of keep myself busy and my thoughts away from being alone in those moments. When I realize I'm having those moments, I just keep myself busy, immersing myself in my kids, in the gym or something, right? Just staying engaged, I guess, really is what I try to do. But when I say cycles, I go through cycles. I would say it's almost clockwork that probably once every 8 to 10 weeks, I will spend a week where I just don't feel like doing anything, and I just don't, can't get motivated. And you know, you start thinking about worst case scenario things. And if you guys look at my social media feed, you'll see posts, and then you'll see a week of empty, and then post, and then you'll see a week of empty. It's very clockwork. My doctors and I have figured that out together, and we work together on that. It's so yeah, it's something that I deal with, and it's also something that those that are close to me deals with as well. I know kids have their own version of that with the things that they're dealing with. Cheryl as well. Many of my friends in the community, same thing. So, you know, here in the house, we look for ways to lift each other up, stay busy, stay engaged. That's, for me, has been the best strategy for me.
Now, Jimmy, I think you have a unique set of circumstances from basically anybody else with Parkinson's disease, and that you're such a large figure within our community. Does that ever add into the depression or the anxiety that you deal with? It's got to be a lot to maintain this, you know, status.
I feel like I let people down when I can't get back to them. Messages that I get through emails or direct messages on Instagram or TikTok or Facebook, I get a lot, and I feel like I let a lot of people down when I don't have a chance to respond, or sometimes I just don't see the message because it gets buried. Instagram likes to put messages that from people that don't follow you or people that you don't follow in a different category called requests. Facebook does the same thing, right? And if I don't see those for weeks or for months, it feels like I've let these people down. They reached out to me for something, and I didn't purposely ignore them, but I've ignored them. When I realize what has happened, I do feel like I've let some people down, and it's tough. Michael told me one time that you're not going to be able to respond to everybody, and you're not going to be able to make everybody happy. The more you try, the harder you're going to make things for yourself. And I still struggle with that. Just talking about it, I just remember like 5 or 6 messages that I saw that I told myself I really should answer, because those are people who are truly looking for something from me that I think I can help, and I haven't gotten back to them. So to be honest, it's tough. It's tough to always doing as many events that I do. It's tough to always have to be on. It's tough to always have to, it's tough to be the center of attention in a lot of these situations. I don't get me wrong. My favorite part about any event I go to is meeting the people in the community. But many of you have heard me talk about this window of movement, right? Where I have 4 to 6 hours in a day that I can be at my best. When I'm at my events, I am timing my medication so that this window is at this event. So then as soon as the event is over, Cheryl will tell you, my kids, my family will tell you, as soon as the event is over and I'm at the airport, my body just crashes. And I'm just there. I'm just a lump of log. Again, I get so much from these events, and I love doing them. But sometimes it's tough knowing that there are people out there looking for help, and even if it's just a little bit of encouragement, don't give up, buddy, keep going. And if I miss that opportunity, I feel bad. I feel like I let somebody down.
To be on a pedestal is a very abusive place to be, I believe. And a lot of people put you on a pedestal, and you're like, dude, I'm a dude. Like, I am here to help whenever I can, but I'm just a person like you. You could do this too. And you've done it by sheer force of will. And I've seen you cooking, and I've seen you off, and I've seen you on. What I really enjoy is when you get vulnerable. And when you get vulnerable, do you feel uncomfortable being on camera when you're really off? Tell us a little bit more about that.
No, at this point, I don't, I think I've showed people all sides of me. And I don't feel uncomfortable being off in front of people, especially within the community, because I know everybody in that room gets it. There's nothing to hide. There's no shame, because everybody gets it in that room, right? But when I'm out in general public, on an airplane, you know, in the grocery store, it is tough. It is tough, but I've gotten to the point that I'm like, these guys want to, you know, if they want to judge, if they want to, you know, think whatever they want to think, it's up to them, because I'm never going to see these people ever again. The chances of me seeing this person on this airplane ever again is probably close to zero. So I'm not going to worry about it, you know. And if they give me the chance, I will I'm more than happy to explain the situation and to help educate them a little bit, so that next time they won't say something that might be insensitive, or won't say anything that they would think twice before saying stuff. So, you know, as far as just being out in the public, I wouldn't say that I'm uncomfortable, but I still find myself grasping on to something to stop tremor. I still find myself putting my hands in my pocket. I still find myself sitting on my hands, you know, even in the car when I'm, you know, my wife is sitting next to me, my kids in the back seat, I still find myself sitting on my hands. It's just, it's, unfortunately, that's become a second nature thing.
That's because Cheryl's so pretty.
I won't argue with that.
Who would you be if you didn't have PD?
Who would I be if I didn't have PD? Yeah, you know, I thought I knew that when I was 20 years old. I thought I knew who I wanted to be. I wanted to be a CEO of some giant corporation making millions and millions of dollars. But I don't think I want that, because I was, you know, in my professional career, I was executive level, and I felt the pressures, and I felt the overall responsibilities that I had to deal with in that situation. And is it worth it? I don't think the stress levels was worth it. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, today, knowing what I know, what I want to be, I just want to be a good parent.
And that's the thing about Jimmy Choi, the humility, the kindness, compassion, no matter what, no matter when. Thank you so much for being our friend and comrade.
That'll do it for tonight, folks. Come back again for more guests, more fun, and more inspiration.
I've come to talk. Have a great night, everybody. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.